This is an interview with Mrs. Hattie, H-A-T-T-Y-E, Lee Shields of 911 Spring Street, Anaheim, California, for the California Odyssey Project, California State College, Bakersfield, California. The interview was conducted by Judith Gannon on May 24, 1981. Okay, Mrs. Shields, let's begin by going back to your childhood in Oklahoma and just begin with your earliest memories and come forward.
I was the seventh of a family of eight. Mother and Dad owned a little farm in McIntosh County, just between Chicota and Henrietta, Oklahoma. My earliest memories are of that little farm, which we called Doodlebug Hill, because it was on a hill. I don't know where the doodlebugs came from. We did not live there long, however, because this was in 1925, and in the latter part of the 20s, Dad lost his farm because he couldn't pay the taxes. We then became sharecroppers.
What happened during that time that your father was not able to pay his taxes?
There were, it was very close to a river, and there were lots of floods along in that period of time. And so it was just a matter of losing too many crops in a row. Then when the floods weren't there, the drought was. So we moved up to about 5 miles or so up into the plain area where the river was no problem. We lived there for several years. It was here, that when we were living there on the plains, that my oldest brother came to California for the first time. He came on a freight train with a friend as a hobo. He came first to Corona, stayed with an aunt in Corona, and from there he went to San Jose, and he was working in the cannery in San Jose for a while. Then he went back home. This was about 1933. And the next time he came out, he brought my oldest sister with him. So they both lived with an aunt in San Jose and worked in the canneries.
How did they travel this time? Did
both? They came on a bus the second time. My mother said no to my sister coming on the freight train.
What did your brother remember about that trip on the freight train? Did he ever
Yes, he did. He talked about that a lot. He mainly remembered the fact that he couldn't get off when he was hungry to get anything to eat, so he just went hungry, and the fact that he had to hide an awful lot from what they called the bulls. And there evidently, at that time, were a lot of men on riding those freight trains. Mm-hmm. So that was a very dramatic period in his life.
And that was what year about?
That was about 1930-31. Okay. Then in 1934, the older sister came home, and this was in the period of extreme drought. We had no well on our farm, the farm that we were sharecropping. We had a cistern, and you're familiar with the cistern. You know you have to collect the water when it rains.
Mm-hmm.
And of course there was no rain, so the cisterns were all dry. Everyone that had a cistern was feeling this particular problem. We had to haul the water. We had to haul the water not only for ourselves, for drinking and all the household needs, chores, washing and all that. We also had to haul the water for cattle, which, you know, and the horses, everything that you have on the farm. So it just got to be a real, all your time was taken up with hauling water. So when the older sister came back from California that time, I'm pretty sure it was with her instigation that Mother and Dad finally decided, well, it had to be better in California.
Now, before you go on to California,
mm-hmm.
How old were you?
I was 10.
Okay.
I was 10 years old at this time.
What do you remember of your life on the farm?
I remember it as being, it was a fun time. When you're young, farm is fun because you've got animals and you've got, with us, we had a lot of brothers and sisters, and mine were all older, except for one. So it was a fun time living on the farm. It was hard in the fact that we didn't have anything. We really had nothing. I remember my sister, just older than myself, was always just very upset with me because I would try to wear her clothes because I didn't have any, you know. And I was a tomboy, and I would whip them. And she and I were always fighting about that. I remember we had one pair of shoes in the fall that was to start school with. And you had to make that one pair of shoes last till the next spring until it got warm enough to go barefoot. That was just a way of life. That was it, you know. And you were lucky to have those. Mother would make dresses for us to go to school out of flour sacks. In those days, they had that nice printed, well, some of them were going back, you know, big flour sacks. And that's what we wore to school. And except in the wintertime, then we wore little zip-up coveralls, sort of like the new jumpsuits are, except they were had the little buttons up. But they were warm. Mm-hmm. And that's what we wore to school in the wintertime.
And you went to school there in...
Yes, I went to school in Oklahoma. In fact, my dad drove a school bus. So we almost froze. There was no heat in the bus. It was his own truck, which he had converted to a school bus. And there was no heat in it. So you sat... Naturally, we got on first. So we sat through the whole run, which was sometimes 20, 25 miles, till we got to school. So we really froze.
Mm-hmm. You must have been one of the first areas to have school buses. Most of the people that I've talked to from that time walked
or rode horses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, our school bus was, like I say, Dad's truck. Mm-hmm. And the school district, the school board, hired him to do this. So this was their first school bus was my dad's truck.
Mm-hmm.
He had it fashioned with canvas flaps, you know, to roll down for the weather. But of course, it didn't keep out rain and snow and cold. It was very cold.
And it was a one-room.
No, we had a school over at Hitchdes where I went to school, and it had a little brick school. In fact, it even went to high school. But the primary grades had a little one-room school. But then, when you got up to be about fourth grade, you moved into the brick schoolhouse, and it had a water. This was outside, of course, an outside water place that had four or five spigots. Four or five people could get a drink at once. And an outhouse down a little bit farther that had six or seven holes, which the boys tipped over every Halloween.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the farmhouse that you had.
Okay. It was small. It was extremely small for as many as we had in the family. In fact, it's still there. I saw it about 3 years ago. You wouldn't believe it. that many people lived in that small house. There was a big, fairly good-sized kitchen where Mother did the cooking and all that. And one big room, which you would now call a family room, which had the kitchen table, and it was a long kitchen table that 10 could sit at with benches. And it had a big pot-bellied stove. That was our only means of warmth throughout the whole house. And then this was all in one room. It was the living room, eating room, get warm room all at once. Mm-hmm. Then there was actually only one bedroom in that house for all these people. But we had a sleeping porch. So there were two or three of us that had to sleep on the sleeping porch. The rest of them slept in the bedroom. Bedrooms were big in those days, and you had three or four beds in them, you know, just were big rooms. And then what was overflow slept in the living room. That's the way we lived.
There was a lot, not much privacy in
there. No, no, there wasn't. You didn't have many questions. That's right. That's right.
Okay. Now, what kinds of crops did your father raise on his farm?
Up on that particular place, he raised some cotton and broom corn and corn, of course. In those days, that was about the main staple crops that you raised mm-hmm. in that area.
Did you had animals too?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And what were your duties or chores?
Well, mainly feeding the chickens, that kind of thing, gathering in the eggs, bringing in the water out of the cistern, gathering up firewood because we had a stove that used just wood, you know, for cooking. Bringing in the coal for the big stove, we used coal in it. That was that, and my homework was about my life as a child.
What did your family do for social or for entertainment?
Well, mostly you do for yourself. When we first moved up there on that particular place, just down the road was an old cousin. I don't think she was an aunt, although I used to call her aunt. And she had one of those old pump organs, and he played the concertina, and we would have music evenings. In fact, in that area, mostly your social life revolved around music. None of us played, except later, my brother played the guitar, but at that point in our life, none of us had any musical instruments that we played. But this aunt and uncle down the road, we would have music evenings with them. Or the other way, another neighbor, we would all go down there and they play extremely good fiddle. So it was that type of thing. Then the church had little socials. And the school was generally the focus of the social life of that type of community. There were parties in the different grades. Each grade sometimes had a party in which you could go and play games and stay late after school and that type of thing. As you got older, then they would actually let the kids come to school at night for the older grades, mm-hmm. and have their parties there. And those were swinging parties.
So you must have gone to at 10. You must have been about a fifth grader then when you left.
Yes.
Oklahoma.
Well, actually, I think I was in the fourth. And when I got to California, they jumped me to the fifth. Mm. On our way, at the time that we decided to come, Dad sold everything he possessed in the way of farming equipment, animals, that type of thing. And he outfitted, at this time then, he had a green Chevy truck that had a flat bed on it. So he outfitted this truck with sideboards, wood sideboards up to the top of the cab of the truck. And then above that, he had bought a huge tent, canvas tent, and he went to a blacksmith shop fellow that he knew, and he fastened him some spokes so that he was able to put this tent up over the top of his truck, and we looked like a Conestoga wagon. That's how we came to California.
Do you have any idea of how much money your family actually started their journey with?
I would say not much. I say that just from the way we lived on the way out. I do say that they really planned pretty good before they started. Dad had the back of the truck, which they call the tailgate, fixed, so that was easily lifted off and could be set on just boxes, and that was our table. And so all the way across the country, we had a table to eat on. And Mother had found this little, some kind of a metal type stove. So we stopped at 3 or 4 in the afternoon and cooked dinner. I'm sure it was just potatoes or gravy and biscuits, but we had a regular dinner. This was on our way out. Most every night we did this.
Did you take quite a few of your household belongings with you?
The feather bed is something else. We sold most of the household things except for the bedding. Dad had fixed bunks in the truck so that there were 2 full-size beds in big bunks. And then I think there were other mattresses beside that. So mainly we brought our sleeping things. And Mother did bring an old trunk that had, and in it she kept all her pots and pans and all that stuff, you know. So she did bring along her necessities. And she brought her feather bed, which the border people wanted so desperately to take away from her, but which we came to California with and went home with.
How?
They inspected it. Do you believe that? They inspected the seams to make sure there were no bed bugs in that feather bed. And, of course, my mother was very religiously doused it every week with kerosene. You know, that's how you do that, you know. So there were none. So he let us bring it in.
Yeah. What, when you say doused it every week with kerosene, what do you mean?
In feathers, you know, you can get tick. I'm sure that, in any beds, if they're old and, you know, and don't get aired and stuff like that, bugs can get mm-hmm. in, especially if you have kids and dogs. Or just plain living. So on the seams, around the edges of your mattresses and stuff, where the bugs would accumulate in the little seams of the things, that's where you put your kerosene. You put kerosene in there, or turpentine or whatever, anything that will kill the bugs, and you just treat them. And that's what she always did. So she had no bed bugs on her mattress.
Yeah. So she or you camped out.
We camped out. We stopped once in Big Spring, Texas, because we had an uncle there that my dad wanted to see his brother. He hadn't seen him for a long time. And we had never met these particular cousins, the children, or the littlest ones anyway. So it was going to be kind of a little get-everybody-get-acquainted type thing. So we stopped in Big Springs, Texas for two or three nights, and it was there that I had my first dust storm. It was horrible. Because we were so close to the river in Oklahoma, I guess we had never had that much dust. We'd had dust, and it was very dusty before we left, just terribly dusty on the roads and stuff, but not that blowing wind that we had in Texas that night. My aunt knew what to do, of course. She'd lived there all her life. Her husband worked in the oil and there in Big Springs, and so she took the wet towels and chinched up around the doors and all this, you know. And, of course, coming into that family with 10 people, we had 12 people in the truck with us on our way out here, 12 and one dog. We called ourselves a Dirty Dozen and a Dog. And coming in there, so there was no room for us all to sleep in the house, so the little kids got relegated to the truck. So we were in the truck during the sandstorm. It was something else. I have never heard the wind blow so fierce. It's such a sound, such a terrible sound. And then you get coughing spells. All of a sudden, you just choke. I mean, even though you're trying to, you wash your face, you take the towel and you keep yourself clean and try to wash your face and all that. And finally, the ones with the worst problems just wet it completely and just put it over their heads. You know, there's just no way that you could keep the dust out. It was the next morning. There was dust. Oh, there was dust piled up inside the house. You know, in little. Wrong the windows, under the doors, you know, when that thing quits. Mm. It was something else. I never want to live through another one of those dust storms.
Imagine, and then being in a tent.
Yeah, it was really in a tent. And even though it was tied down good, it was terrible. Mm. It finally came out, and the worst got the littlest kids, you know. Let the bigger boys and stuff stay all night in the tent. But it was very bad.
Your father really must have had that thing lashed down.
He did. It was well put together. It was well put together.
So you had your family of 10 and...
My Aunt Hattie, who I'm named after, and her two small children. The youngest was just a baby. And the oldest was about 2. And the other was just a baby. Her husband was already here in Arvin, and she was coming out with us. And then, of course, the dog. So we had 12 and a dog.
And most of you, I assume, then rode in the back of the truck?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was 2 that could ride in the front with Dad, so that 3 could be in the cab. But all the rest rode. And the way it was fixed was so we could lay on that top bunk and look out. And that was beautiful. Coming across country, laying up there and looking out, we had to fight, of course, who gets the lookout now and that type of thing, the way families do. But it was a fun trip. I know it was hard on Mother and Daddy because they were going into a very uncertain type thing, but for the young ones, it was just fun.
Mm-hmm.
It really was.
So after you spent time at Big Springs, Texas,
mm-hmm.
then where...
We came right on. We didn't make any other stops.
Came to Corona, right?
Right. One place, and I believe it was at Bixby, Arizona, we found a hill that was so steep. This was the old 66, and I think it was at Bixby, Arizona. We found a hill so steep that we had to get out and unload part of the, and a lot of us had to walk to the top. And coming through the Ute Mountains, that's also in Arizona, was quite an exciting thing. Those are where they have the real hairline curves. You know, you come back on yourself,
mm-hmm.
you find yourself coming back.
Right.
And one of the things we saw coming across country that I thought was very interesting, because besides a lot of people in our same situation, were car caravans. This was mostly men who were driving cars, who were pulling cars.
Okay, you were talking about the car caravan.
Yes, these men were driving these cars evidently from somewhere in the Midwest or around to sell in California.
Okay, we were still talking about...
Those cars.
Right.
Well, the men in these cars, that we were all going about the same speed because they had a heavy load just about the same as we did. So we became real good friends with these men in these cars. We would pass the same ones, and then the next hill they'd be passing us. And, of course, they were all friendly and waved at the kids and everything. So this was one of the most interesting things on the way out, was seeing the different people that were coming and what they were coming in and how they were arriving.
A lot of different kinds of...
Yeah, everything. You can just imagine, you know, some... Little cars with people so crammed in them, you wonder how they, and some with people sitting on their laps even, you know, just really crammed in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got you almost to the California border, but before we do that, when you were living in Oklahoma sharecropping, do you remember any time that your father talked about any of the farm policies that were designed to try to bring the prices up during that period?
I wasn't so aware of it so much then as later. I'm sure that he talked about it with his friends and mother, you know, but just never discussed that type of thing in front of the kids. So
you don't remember any experiences of having to slaughter cattle or destroy crops or anything like that?
Oh, well, I remember the part about the cattle, some of that, you know, and that hurt my father very much. You know, you just can't know how much it hurts a farmer to have to do this type of thing when he's raised his crop and raised his cattle and stuff, and then to have to do that type of thing. It just breaks their heart.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's just against everything they believe.
Your dad was in a position, though, of having to actually do that, or were there other farmers that you knew of?
Well, I know that the ones that had more, you know, we probably never had that many, but I know that there were ones that had more that found themselves in this situation. I think there was a lot of selling of livestock along about that time so that they wouldn't get themselves into this kind of situation, practically giving it away so that the people that didn't have any would have it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You talked before about the inspection at the border.
Yes, this was quite a shock, this inspection at that border. There were cars lined up you wouldn't believe. It was worse than a freeway thing you've ever seen, you know. A long line of cars waiting to come through. And there were cars that they were pulling over, cars that they had just let through, you know, with just a look or stuff. But anyone that was carrying any goods at all, any household goods or anything, was pulled over and just really checked thoroughly. And this was at the time that we had the business with the feather bed, with Mother and her feather bed. My family looked fairly healthy, so there wasn't a long wait for us. But it was just the manner in which they conducted it that was... we'd never had that type of situation with before, with people in command. We had never run into that type of situation. I don't know if my dad ever had. I'm sure he didn't. He was at one time a county sheriff in Oklahoma. And so he was a very well... respected man in his area. Mother was a very proud woman. To be treated like that in that situation with these border guards or whatever they call themselves, inspectors, was very, very demeaning to them. They just didn't get over that for a long time.
The attitude of the people was more than just an inspection to see if you had... were bringing anything with you.
Right.
It sounds like what you're saying is that
they were trying to get people not to come in, is what it was, I'm sure. They were trying their best, everything they could find, to turn people back. And, of course, they just couldn't. I mean, they're just, if they couldn't find anything, they couldn't. They couldn't turn them back.
Mm-hmm.
There just wasn't that part of the law yet. So they had to let them through. So they came through, and we did.
Yeah. We came to
Corona, and that because Mother had a sister there. In fact, she had a lot of family in Corona area, and this was where my oldest brother was at the time, working in the lemon factory, in the lemon harvest. So this was about April, as I remember it, March or April. So the smaller ones of us had to go to school to finish out that year. And I remember we had a nice little house. It was the nicest house we've ever had. In a little street over in Corona. It was on an orange grove and a lemon grove in front of us, and an empty house next door that had a strawberry patch. So we were in heaven. We were just, and Father, of course, admonished us not to steal oranges, absolutely not to pick oranges. So every morning on our way to school, we got one orange each. That was our, we knew we wanted an orange for lunch, and that was our thing. We would all look to see who, if anyone was coming, and we would go and we would steal one orange each to have for our lunch.
What did you find the school to be like here in California? Was it any, did you feel that you were treated any different or anything that you remember about?
In Corona, not so much as in, up in the valley. Yeah. Up in the valley, even though there was a feeling in Corona already that these were people that were just, we felt a little bit of difference. Mm-hmm. Kids were not as friendly as they would have been if we'd have been, you know, someone moving into town or something. They knew we were going to be short. Termers. They knew we were just going to be there for a while, so they didn't take the time to bother to get acquainted.
So your father had no plan to remain in Corona?
No, and he knew that, and everybody else knew that.
What did he do while you were living in Corona?
He and mother and all the older ones in the family worked in the lemon factory, the Sunkissed Lemon place. They grated lemons.
And
when that quit, then we went, moved on to the valley. Yes, when we first got to Corona, Dad had taken a weekend to take the aunt that we brought with us up to Arvin and come back. So while he was there, he scouted out a little bit, so he knew what he was going into. So we went to Arvin first, and I think they worked just a little bit in the grapes there.
Okay, your family was then only in Corona for a couple of months?
Two or three at the most. I'm sure it was until after school was out. I'm sure we finished up school there.
Okay.
And then we went to Arvin. The grape harvest, I don't remember doing anything in it at all, because I'm sure that I was too small to do anything with the grape harvest. Now that I know what they do in a grape harvest, I know that that was the reason. But the older ones in the family and Dad was fortunate in a lot of ways. He had the truck, and so he could contract out for trucking, you know, for helping move, haul things. But he was unfortunate in the fact that he wasn't very strong, so the heavy lifting of the boxes and everything was not good for his health. So it was a sort of a half-and-half situation. While we were in Arvin, we pitched our tent on the aunt's property, which, you know, we were not in the camps, so to speak. However, we did have a cousin who was in one of the camps at Weed Patch. So they have lived in Lamont all this time. Their children were grown up there, and they have lived in Lamont area and still living in there.
What do you recall their saying about the government camp? I assume that it was the government camp at Weed Patch.
Yes, it was. It was the government camp at Weed Patch. And they weren't happy there for a lot of reasons. They were happy because the facilities were better. I mean, they had the bathrooms and that type of thing. But they were unhappy because of everybody that was in there and the restrictions. They considered restrictions. I'm not real clear about, you know, I'm sure it's just a matter of when you have a home and you're living, you know, and you come in with all these people, of course there have to be restrictions, but it's hard for people who are very independent people to be told, you know, that a certain time of night you do this, certain time of night you do that, and nobody can wash except now, and that type of thing, you know. Mm-hmm. It's just awfully hard for an independent people. I think most of the people from Oklahoma that came out here in the 30s were very independent people. I think it was just that type of life back there. Mm-hmm.
at least all the friends that I know that came out were that way. We did have one occasion where we lived in a camp. Only one time that I remember living in a camp, and that was in Wasco. I think we left Arvin and went to Wasco for the potatoes. I think that was our next stopping place, which, you know, it's not very far. Mm-hmm. And at that particular time, it was not an organized camp. The organized camp was too full. We couldn't get in there. And this was one of those little catch-up type things, you know, where everybody comes and settles on this mm-hmm. empty lot.
Oh.
That was one of those.
Was it a private grower owned, or was it a part of a government?
No, I'm sure it was private land. I'm just positive that it was private land because there were no facilities at all. It was just a bunch of people out here in this little place, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We stayed there about a week. Dad said he just wouldn't have his children living like that. And so he found a grower, an independent grower, who would let him come onto and live on his property. At the time we came, we were the first ones to come there. It turned out to be wonderful friends, that man and his family. Just wonderful friends.
Your father didn't want his children to live like that. What problems were there in that?
Well, mainly facilities for keeping clean. You just didn't have them. You know?
Okay, you were just talking about leaving the private camp with no facilities. How did your father locate this gentleman?
Well, he was a very resourceful man, my father was, and he would go out and get his own jobs. He didn't just wait for the call to come, there's so and so. He just went and looked. And this man, although he couldn't hire us, he didn't have any crops of his own. He did have a place that had maybe 15 acres there. It was just in trees and stuff, and it was a perfect place for a camp, although there was none there. But he did allow Dad to move in, and at this place we set up our tent and built a brush arbor and had a beautiful little camp because it was just so clean and under the eucalyptus trees, just really lovely.
What is a brush arbor?
I was hoping you'd ask me that. A brush arbor is a patio with brush around it. Of course, there's no cement. It's just hard dirt. You sweep it clean, and then you take leaves or branches off of the trees, and you put it up along the side to keep the sun out, and then you put it across the top and make yourself a little lean-to. That's a brush arbor. And they're really nice up in the valley because, you know, it's so hot there.
Yeah.
You just can't get any shade sometimes.
The other thing is that if this place wasn't set up to be a camp, what did you use for facilities there?
Well, it was obvious that with the crowd that Dad had, the man's facilities couldn't be used. I mean, that would be overtaxed, but very fast. So he let us build a little outhouse out in the woods there, out in the little trees.
Mm-hmm.
So Dad built his own little outhouse, and we had that. Then for bathing stuff, of course, we had to do that inside the tent, but we had more room.
Mm-hmm.
So that wasn't a problem.
Carried water from his well.
We had a particular problem with that at first, but then there was just down the street from him, there was a lady who owned quite a place, and she had a reservoir. So she gave us permission to use the water from the reservoir. So we would take our buckets and go over and put it under the spout, you know, the water coming out of the pipe at the reservoir, and we had nice, clean, fresh water. So we really had it nice there. However, at this particular time in our trip was when my father and my sister Polly, that's just older than I am, started having boils. We had to go to the doctors. They had to have them lanced, these horrible carbuncles all over their bodies. Doctors said it was the living conditions, of course, the dirt and, you know, and all the unsanitary conditions just coming out, you know. You just don't have the way to keep your food as clean. You have no way of keeping it refrigerated. I mean, there's no way you can, you had to use what food you had that day and get more of the next day if it was perishable at all.
Mm-hmm.
course, potatoes aren't perishable. You can keep those nicely. And Mother made her biscuits every morning and every night. She made fresh bread every morning and every night. That was how we had our meals. We ate a lot of gravy in those days. And in fact, she coined, I don't know if it was her or one of the girls, but we made a chocolate gravy. We got so sick of white gravy that we made this chocolate gravy. It's really just a thin chocolate pudding, but you eat it with biscuits like a gravy, and that's many a morning that's what we had to eat. I actually liked it.
I would think that if you like chocolate.
Yeah, it was really good. It was really good, chocolate pudding every morning.
When you said that your father and sister started having boils, I've always thought that boils were some kind of a virus or infection.
They're a blood disease.
Yeah.
They really are a blood disease.
Nothing
uh-huh.
to do with cleanliness or anything.
Well,
like that.
The doctors didn't think so at that time. They thought it was mainly from, you know, from the cleanliness mm-hmm. and the probably more so from the water than anything else. The water just was not. A lot of people used well water, of course, and which probably was just. But those reservoir waters and the water people had to use was not very clean.
How did
not
that,
like
what
now.
Happened? Did they continue to have that?
They had that all the time we were in California. They didn't get rid of those boils till we got back to Oklahoma. They saw doctors in Wasco, Tipton, Tulare, San Jose.
Right up the coast.
They saw doctors in all those places. And of course, you know, as long as your conditions are that way, that's they're not going to go away.
What, I've forgotten what I was doing.
Where we are? We're in Wasco.
I know where we are. It just slipped right out of my mind what I was going to. Oh, did you manage to have the money to pay for the medical?
I don't know how the medical was arranged. I don't know if they really did pay for that or if it was any kind of health care mm-hmm. at all or what. I rather imagine that was actually paid for out of the little bit that we had.
So at this time, your father was working, you were living in the eucalyptus grove
mm-hmm.
and your father was working the potatoes?
Mm-hmm. We all worked the potatoes. Every one of us worked the potatoes, even the littlest girl. And that was a dirty job. That was a horrible, dirty job. It was not so bad for us, the younger ones, because what we did was we would pile the potatoes up in little piles. Then the bigger ones would come along with the sacks and pick them, put them in the sacks, you know, so we wouldn't have to carry the sacks.
Mm-hmm.
But those sacks were heavy. When they're full, that's a heavy,
yes.
That's a lot of potatoes.
That's
yes, that's a 100-pound sack of potatoes. That's what they were. And later on, we would carry little buckets, you know, when it got to be...
Were you able to keep some of the potatoes for your own use?
I'm sure that we did, because I remember we ate an awful lot of potatoes. And probably what it was, that we got the ones that were cut in two, you know, from the digger.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the ones that we were able to take home and eat.
Do you remember your parents talking anything about wages at that time, what you got for picking potatoes?
I don't remember. I know it was just cents. You know, I know it was just really cents a sack. I don't believe it was, it may have been 10, 12 cents, something like that, for a 100-pound sack. It was very little. I remember that part.
Mm-hmm.
But I know you had to pull an awful lot of potatoes to make any money at all.
Yeah,
and I'm sure the reason that we had any money at all, like to pay the doctor or anything, was the fact that there were so many of us
mm-hmm.
that were working.
So your diet then consisted pretty much of potatoes and biscuits and...
And gravy.
And gravy. Mm-hmm.
I can't hardly remember along through that part of the valley anything else. I really can't. I remember sometimes fresh fruit, but that was because we happened to be visiting someone or something that had fresh grapes or something like that,
mm-hmm.
or wherever we happened to be.
Was there any time for social activities, or was it pretty much...
Oh, this was, at this particular place where we were, was fun time for social. This girl that owned the place, there was a daughter and a son. Son was just older than I was, and then the daughter was about the same age as one of my older brothers. So they had parties, and this was where I was introduced to, you know, group parties.
Mm-hmm.
This was really fun. We had one time a backward party. it was just a lot of fun. And this is where I learned about the post office and how you play post office and spin the bottle. And and I don't remember what the name of the thing was, but you just go out for walks around, you know, the place. And it was those type of fun parties.
To make my to get it clear in my head, you lived in the eucalyptus grove in Wasco, right? Okay, all right, go ahead. You were, so how long did you stay in the
there? The potatoes went out probably along toward the fall, because our next stop was Tipton, in where we stayed and picked cotton. So in the Tipton Tularia area. And school was already starting, so that had to be in September and October. So that was our next stop. And we found a strange living thing here, which I enjoyed very much. We had different living places than a lot of people in California. We started off by living on this man's place, just like a lot of people were at the time that was working for him. And my father still just did not like that, living with so many people, such close proximities. I remember my two older sisters having a fight. I know this is what sparked the moving out situation from, and it was simply over a matter of who was going to wear a pair of shoes to a particular party, you know, or a dance or something. Right after that, we found this little cabin on the edge of this man's property. It was a rundown cabin. You have no idea. Out here in this cow pasture. But we moved into it, and it turned out to be, we lived there until the next, we went through the winter in this cabin. So we had a roof over our heads. We had shelter from the rain and everything. And this was all through the cotton picking season until the next spring. It was quite a place. I learned about cow chips and how they'll burn for fuel. They make a nice fire. You have to be awful careful. That was our chore, the young ones, was to go out and round up the cow chips. We took an old sack, you know, a tow sack, potato sack, and went out, and we learned fast that you take a stick and you poke it in the middle. If it doesn't go through, it's dry enough to burn.
How did you learn about this?
You learn that trial and error, I'm afraid.
No, I mean that
they burn?
Cow chips burn.
Our father was a cowboy in his early days in Texas. So before he married, he was a cowboy. So he knew that you can burn cow chips. Oh, that was quite a place. We had a session with the bees. There were bees in that little shack that inside the walls, and my older sister was the kind that had to have a clean house, so she was up one day dusting the walls and discovered this hive of bees. So one of my brothers decided he was get rid of the bees. She didn't like bees. And we had the biggest fight of bees you ever saw. The bees ran us out of the house before we got them all killed. It was terrible.
Oh.
It was a nice area, Tipton was. I liked the school in Tipton. Had a great teacher. I really loved that school in Tipton Elementary School. She was a very hot, warm, understanding woman, and understood a lot about migrant children, and tried her best to make us at ease and into the group of the, so that we didn't have as much problem there as we had other places. Tipton had a nice remembrance for me, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Describe your little house in the pasture that with the bees in the walls.
Describe it?
Yeah.
It had place had one big room and then one bedroom off of that room. So it really was just an open shelter. It had a good roof. It didn't leak. And it had a wood floor. Of course, the planks had space between them. You know, you had to watch for crawlies coming up out of the thing. And it would just sit out there by itself, right there in the corner of this pasture. It had a place where you could go, where Dad could drive his truck in. I think there was a shed of something out back, but I don't think it was usable. I think it had just fallen down, was in just such disrepair that it couldn't be used.
Did Did you have, like, water there?
Oh, no, we always had to carry our water. Don't remember having any place, other than when we first got here in Corona, where we had water available. You always had to go and get it in buckets and barrels and whatever. Just don't remember ever having any running water or any water in a well-type situation at all.
Now, in this Tipton area, did your older brothers and sisters then work the cotton
fields? Yes.
And your
mother and dad? My mother and dad. Everybody worked the cotton fields. In fact, I remember the younger ones, too. We would go and work the cotton fields when we had the chance after we got home and stuff. So we all worked, every one of us.
Do you remember anything about how much you were paid for the cotton?
Again, I don't remember exactly. My older brother would remember. I should have asked him those things. But I know it was just cents. You know, it was. It might have been $1, $100. I doubt it. I don't think it was even 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was mighty low.
Mm-hmm. So when you were in Tipton, you went back to school, but you didn't feel like there was any discrimination against you?
Right there, it was the best feeling I had.
Mm-hmm.
So I think probably there was a lot in my particular age group, in my own class. I think there was a lot. The older ones, the older students, I think understood or had a little better, you know, feeling toward the younger ones anyway. You know, like sixth graders were a little more understanding about the fourth graders and so forth. But I think there was quite a bit, you know, especially with girls. They're afraid that a new girl is going to get their boyfriend, even if they're 10 years old. They have this feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the kind of a 10-year-old girl, I'd do it. if I could at all, you know.
Yeah.
So that was that type of thing among the kids.
But not the feeling that it was a natural kind of rivalry, not a
no, it was not on the economic type thing. No, not particularly right there.
Okay.
I didn't feel that too much, in fact, in the schools in California.
Did you ever remember your folks talking about the way that they were treated by the local people in California?
I remember my father. I think this is why he always went to the independent growers, to the small guy, you know, instead of going with the big farms like a lot of people did. I'm pretty sure this is why he did this. That he felt more of a kinship with them because he was a farmer himself.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that they would be more understanding of him and his problems and his family than the big, companies
mm-hmm.
and stuff. So he really stayed away from the large places. I just don't remember us ever working for one of the big places.
Mm-hmm.
I remember us. In all the places that we worked, it was always a small grower, a small farmer. And usually we lived right on their land.
Mm-hmm.
And just on that one incident there in Arvin and stuff, where we coming out of there, where we had to live for just a little while.
So you didn't feel that as far as you were concerned, that or as far as you ever heard your parents talk about, that there was a good deal of either hostility by the local people or that you had to watch the growers every minute to keep them from taking advantage of them?
No, I didn't get that. They may have had it, but I may have just been too young,
mm-hmm.
you know, to know that part of it. But they didn't talk about it in front of the kids anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So all my feelings and connections with people all up and down the valley in that period of time were good. They were very good. That's why, to me, it was a fun year.
Mm-hmm.
It really was. I used to think it was only because I was 10. But now that I'm older and think about more, I think that it was a good situation
mm-hmm.
as far as I was concerned.
How was it for you having to change schools every few
years? That was hard. I didn't like that. That was very hard. I was more adaptable than my other sisters. I just happened to be more outgoing.
Mm-hmm.
They had a very hard time of it. The one that was sick and had the boils,
mm-hmm.
She had a very hard time in school. she just knew everybody hated her, and I think a lot of it was because of the fact that she was usually covered up with bandages here and there, you know. And I'm sure that it was a lot her feelings, but she had that feeling. She did. She felt like she was very looked down on. And, of course, then the younger sister, I think she didn't bother her a bit. She was too young. Mm-hmm. She was just 8, so it didn't really, you know, get too much on her.
So you stayed in this little cabin for the, for the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And where did you go after you left Tipton?
After we left Tipton, we went to San Jose. The next thing that I remember of any work that we had was in San Jose. And here again, we had an aunt there in town, and so we stayed with her until the prune season, until the prunes were ripe. That was all there was in San Jose area. However, along through this period of time, the older ones of the family did work in the canneries. They worked in San Jose area in the canneries, and I'm sure they went up ahead of us through the winter part, you know, they could get work up there. So we went and we landed in this big house in San Jose with my aunt and a lot of boarders. And I don't know how many people there were in that house. And so as soon as the prunes got ripe then, Dad found another grower and we moved out onto his property again to pick up the prunes. And it was a very hard time right here because school was... It was long in the spring, and we didn't go to school in San Jose for some reason. I think it was a matter of distance. I don't think there was any buses, or for some reason we did not go to school in San Jose. And my older brother, he would have been in the graduating class in our school in Oklahoma, and he missed his friends desperately. So... we hadn't been in San Jose too long. One day he developed a very severe headache. So he stayed home from picking prunes that day. Everybody went but him, and he stayed home. And so my mother went back to the place to fix lunch for everybody, and here she came running, screaming, "Bud, Bud, Bud." That was my dad, was named Bud. "Noel's gone, Noel's gone." So we all got in a truck and ran home, and he had left. He had left us a little note saying, "Don't worry, I've got some money. I'll write you in a couple of days. I'm on my way back to Oklahoma." So everybody had to pile into the truck, and we all went to the police, and we put out this missing persons report on he must have been 16 or 17. No, he would have had to been 17. Because he was going to be graduating that year. So the policeman was very nice. The policeman in San Jose was very nice. He told us, "Just relax. I'm sure he'll be okay. There's a lot of people on the roads. You know, everybody's safe. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to hurt him," and so forth. And you'll hear from him in a few days. And it was a week, and it was a sad week. It was a very sad week. Yeah. And finally then, a telegram came from a cousin in Oklahoma saying, "Noel has arrived, and he will stay with us till school's out." So, but that was the straw that broke my father. And so he decided that, okay, this was it. After the harvest was over with, we would not stay in California any longer.
Did he always not like California, or was he just so concerned about his son that...
Well, I think he felt, and I heard him talking, the mother, about this, that the children were going in every which direction. There were just no cohesion. You know, the older ones were off in the cannery working. Excuse me. We left one sister in in Tipton to work.
Okay. So your brother Noel was at that point back in Oklahoma,
yes.
And you started to say that you'd left a sister in Tipton.
She was a housekeeper for one of the school teachers there in Tipton. So we left her there, and some of the others had gone here and there, so we were beginning to branch out, and Father was very upset about that. He felt like the older ones that was only natural. They were going to do that. But he didn't want the little ones, the young ones, to be running here and there. And he was afraid of that. He really was desperately afraid of that. Plus, he wasn't happy. He was still having boils. His health was still bad. And so he just decided he would be better off back in Oklahoma. So we went.
Okay. Before we go back to Oklahoma, do you remember, or was your father involved in any strikes or attempts to organize the workers during that?
No, he stayed completely away from that. Now, I don't know about my older brother. I never asked him that, but I know that he knew about that all that was going on. Mm-hmm. And whether or not he actually got involved in it, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Because I don't, you know, he wasn't with me at the time. I have a suspicion he did, because later he was very much in the union in the aircraft industry where he worked and everything.
So this was the brother that you came to that was working the lemons?
Right. He's the one that came to California first. Uh-huh. I'm sure that he was involved in this in some way.
Mm-hmm. So your father decided that rather than having his family going willy-nilly here and there, that he would just pack up
back.
And so you went back to Oklahoma in the truck?
In the truck.
Like you'd come out?
Although this time we had a car with us. The older brother now had a car, and so he took, we all but one went back. The sister that was in Tipton as a housekeeper stayed. We all stayed, as soon as we got back, the older brother and the sister, the older sister, came back immediately. I mean, they stayed a month or so, but then they came right back. So then,
to Oklahoma?
Yes.
To California?
No, to Oklahoma.
Okay.
So that they came back to help us get back, and that was it.
Okay.
So then they came back.
Now I'm confused.
there were so many of us.
So
I understand
your one sister stayed here in Tipton.
Right.
But your other, the ones that were here, went back to Oklahoma
with
you
us. Uh-huh.
To help you get settled,
right.
And then came back to California.
Right, that's
okay.
Right. Yeah, you're not confused at all.
what kind of work did your dad go back to when you got...
Farming. He went back to farming.
Did he buy a farm? Or?
No, he just sharecropped then for the rest of the time that we were there. We stayed until 1940.
Okay, so this would have been in...
This was 36.
In 36. You spent the year of 36...
35 and 36 in California.
Mm-hmm. In the fall of
36, we went back
to Oklahoma, back to sharecropping, and
stayed for four more years.
Four more years. What prompted you to come back out then in 1940?
Then in 1940, he lost his last son. I mean, didn't lose him. He was graduating from high school, and there's nothing there, you know. So he naturally, all the other brothers and sisters were out here working, so he wanted to come too. So he let him come. He let him come by himself, and I think he only stayed a little while and then came home. But that year, he had to farm with three little girls, and he learned that you cannot farm with three little girls. So that did it. Plus, that ever since we had come back from California, his health just deteriorated. He never recovered completely from the boils and that particular part of his life. He developed other health problems, which I think were directly related to that. Mm-hmm. So that when we came to California in 1940, we got here in April. In August of that year, he died. Yeah, he just never recovered from that particular part of his life.
When you came back in 40, where did you come to?
We came to Hawthorne, right down here in Southern California, because that the sister that we left in Tipton had since married, and she and her husband had lived down here, and he was already working in the aircraft factory. Mm-hmm. And then my older brother was already in the aircraft factory, and one younger one, so that's where we came. We came to Hawthorne.
And so you must have been about 15?
I was 14 then.
14.
Mm-hmm.
And your mother had three little girls
still.
And how did you manage then from the time...
From the time that my dad died?
Mm-hmm.
Well, not very well. It was hard. It was really extremely hard. The older brother, everybody was married except, the last one to graduate. He was living at home with us. And he was working he had just gotten a job in the industry, and so the three of us were still in high school. But the one just older than me was already 16. So she quit school and went to work, and then not long after that got married. So we were close. We were close to the brothers and sisters, and they helped out as much as they could.
Your mother worked for you?
She tried to. She tried to work in a little school cafeteria. She tried to work at the hospital cafeteria. She was not trained to do anything. Mm-hmm. She'd never done anything except be a mother, you know, and housewife. It was awfully hard on her. Myself and the younger one, we had part-time jobs, anything we could find, you know, after school. So this is how we got by until I graduated from high school in 1943. And then I went to work in the aircraft factory.
Uh-huh.
And not in a factory, but in for the government. For the government.
So the aircraft industry
saved us. So that was what really took us from, you know, the farm, really.
Mm-hmm.
It was that particular time, just before the war, just before we got into the war.
Yeah.
The war was on. This, we hadn't gotten into it yet, yeah.
So was there any thought in your father's mind when he came back to California in 1940 to go back to the San Joaquin Valley? Or?
He did. He died there.
Oh.
He his health was not good enough to go into any of the factories or anything like that, and he couldn't just sit and do nothing. So he went to Arvin, to some old friends. He stayed with he was living with his sister at the time he died, and he was working picking cotton for an old friend that had a little farm up there.
Mm-hmm.
And when he died very suddenly. It was a doctor said a blood clot, which it was from his problem with the blood.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, he was 54 years old when he died.
Well, sounds like probably all that hard work.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Just work himself to death,
mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
He did.
So you worked in the aircraft industry and then met your husband? And
no, I worked in the aircraft factory. I was with the government in the aircraft factory, and I supported mother and the younger sister. Then we moved to Alameda because the older brother had moved up there. Not having a father around, we stayed as close as we could to one of the older brothers, and he moved to Alameda, so I moved up there too. And I was going to school at Berkeley and working, and when the youngest sister got married, then I decided I would go away to college. She took mother then, and back down here, to back down in Southern California, and I went to school in Pasadena. That's where I met my husband.
Oh.
So he's an educator.
Mm-hmm. You went to Pasadena City College down here?
It was a private college, mm-hmm. Pasadena College,
oh.
Private little college, and we both met there. He came from Massachusetts, so he came out here to college, and I came.
Okay, we got you married off and living in Pasadena or going to school in Pasadena,
mm-hmm.
But let's back up a second and talk about what your family thought of Roosevelt and his policies.
Well, mother and father were both Democrats. They just didn't understand the Republican Party at all. They were just, most of that country, I think, were Democrat and is still, mm-hmm. Primarily. Oklahoma is still, I think, Democratic. But he was not happy with Roosevelt. He was, in the beginning, I think, probably, thought Roosevelt was a great man, was doing all kinds of wonderful things. But as he came longer and longer in office, my father was just not happy at all with some of the things that Roosevelt was doing. He knew, he really realized that it probably was the best thing that could be done under the situations. My father was very up on current affairs, and he kept himself very current on what was going on in politics and in the country in general. And he wasn't happy with the party right at the very end of his life, I know. I don't know any specifics that he wasn't happy with. Mm-hmm. I know that Social Security to him was not a good thing. Probably if he had lived his life out, he would probably have come to see that it was.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe now he wouldn't. It's one of those.
No.
Yeah, right. But I, as I grew up and became a Republican myself, I realized that my father was more Republican than he was Democratic. He just had joined the wrong party.
Mm-hmm.
He just didn't really know what a Republican was. Or didn't have a Republican Party to join in those places. But his feelings and his individuality and his own resourcefulness and his, all that, I think, was more in keeping with the Republican Party than the Democratic. So,
what about, did your family ever have any occasion to be involved with the WPA?
Yes, and that just broke his heart. This was in Oklahoma. After we had gone back, things were still very bad, and things were really hard. And they were bringing clothes into the school and giving away free clothes, and they were bringing apples, that type of thing, to help the people. And that hurt my father very much, the fact that his family had to take, he called it charity, even, you know, and he, mm-hmm. he hurt him that his family had to take that. But you did, you just did mm-hmm. take it. And there was nothing, this particular place, and so a lot of men were going to work for the WPA, and he just insisted he would not. Well, finally, my mother just kept at him and kept at him until he did. He did go to work for the WPA the last year that we were in Oklahoma, and I don't know what he did. I can't remember what they were doing. I think it had something to do with a coal mine up around in Oklahoma there somewhere. They were doing something in the coal mines, but it just broke his heart that he had to come to working for the government. He just didn't think people should have to work for the government.
Did you managed to be able to live in California that year without having to have any help from?
We had no help from the government at all, unless it was the medical.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only thing I can think of that we might have had some help from.
Mm-hmm. And those 3 years after you got back from California into Oklahoma, he attempted to farm the land
right.
without any help, without any assistance. And then finally,
he finally had to give it up. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's the another contributing thing to why he came back in 1940.
Mm-hmm.
Probably would have stayed right there if he had been able to make it.
Yeah. What when your family came to California, many of them came with the idea of owning land in California. Do you think your father had that kind of a dream?
I think he did. I think he found the place he would like to have it. I think it was up around in the Tipton, Porterville, Tulare area up in there. He loved that little section of country.
Mm-hmm.
He did. I think he would have loved to have had a little farm up in there.
Mm-hmm.
It was just out of the question as far as money situation and everything else was concerned. But he did like that part of the
mm-hmm.
country.
So it wasn't so much that he didn't like California.
Oh, no. I'm sure he liked California. Mm-hmm. He loved the weather. He did. He loved
the
weather.
San Joaquin Valley?
Well, you know that little place that I was talking about, that little shack out there on the pasture that we lived in. I'll never forget the winter we were there. A rainstorm. We were all in bed, and all of a sudden, my father gets up in the middle of the night, goes out in his night clothes outside, takes one of the wash tubs, a big wash tub, turns it upside down, and puts it under the eaves. The next morning, I just didn't believe he did that, you know. I said to my mother, "Why did Daddy turn the tub upside down?" She says, "He wanted to hear the rain." She said, "It just sounded so good. He wanted to hear the rain."
You don't get to hear the rain too often.
That's true. Not up there.
So, did you live then after you were married in Pasadena?
It's a very funny thing about how I can't get away from the San Joaquin Valley. My husband graduated there. I worked in Pasadena. I didn't graduate. I had my first daughter, my first child, right after we were married, about a year after. So I didn't graduate. I worked and put him through college. And his very first teaching job was Wasco, California. Would you believe there I am right back in Wasco?
Oh.
A little old house. house in Wasco. It was, you know, I tried and tried to find that place where we lived and couldn't. I couldn't find it. Whether it had been, you know, taken down or just I was looking in the wrong places, I don't know.
So you lived in Wasco then for a while?
Just a couple of years. A
couple of years, came back down here to Southern.
Yes, then we were in Whittier. We were in Whittier, and he taught there. And after we left Whittier, actually, he became a principal and came to Garden Grove, which is, you know, right next door here in Anaheim. And he's been there ever since. Next year we retire, and guess where we're going?
To the San Joaquin Valley.
No, no, we're going to Oklahoma.
Why
am I going full circle again?
Yeah.
Well, in Oklahoma, I don't know, have you been there? They took those rivers that used to flood and ruin the crops and cut it all up and made a beautiful lake. It's called Lake Eufaula. And it's just gorgeous. One of my older sisters went back about 4 or 5 years ago and built a beautiful home there, right on the edge of the lake. Mm-hmm. And we've just bought a home on the edge of the lake.
That sounds fantastic.
It's really nice now. It's not like it was. It's just not like it was at all.
Be your first trip back to Oklahoma?
No, I made that about five or six years ago. It was interesting. It really was. That was my first trip back since I'd left. That was a long time. That was 40 years in between, almost.
Sure was.
It was quite a experience, meeting old friends that I'd known when I was a girl. I wouldn't have known them. So, very few of them, anyway. Yeah. You know, some of the older ones I would have. They didn't change, and they're still there. Mm. They're in their 80s and 90s. Mm. I didn't believe that. But now in this southeastern part of Oklahoma, this Lake Eufaula, is a beautiful lake, and beautiful fishing lake.
Ah, then your husband can go
loves
fishing.
Loves it. He loves it. He's going to go back there and sit and go fishing.
Before we turn off the tape, is there any period or anything, any experience that you can think of that we didn't talk about during your years' journeys through California? Anything that you would like to mention that I forgot to ask you about?
Well, you don't want to go through the war years in Southern California, do you?
Well, you can touch on them briefly if you wish.
Well, the reason I thought about that was because where we lived in Hawthorne, there was an empty lot across the street from us. This was before I was out of high school. And the big anti-aircraft battery moved in there. I don't know how many soldiers there were, but they took up the whole empty block, you know, just the whole block. And this was at the time that... right after they'd moved in, you know, this was when the streets were all dark and everything, and one night this anti-aircraft battery opened up just fierce. They were shooting like crazy out there. We all went out running out to see what they were shooting at and stuff. It was the time that there was supposed to have been a Japanese plane come over Southern California.
Oh.
It later turned out probably to be a weather balloon. They were never sure, remember? But I was out there watching this anti-aircraft battery shooting at this thing in the sky. The next morning we went out and picked up the pellets, the shrapnel pellets from them. Crazy. No, it was quite a time growing up in Southern California.
During the war years.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would imagine that would have been quite an interesting
Yeah, it was.
Do you think that as far as you are concerned, it sounds like your memory of that year traveling through the San Joaquin Valley is a pleasant one.
It is. It's very pleasant. It's the people that we met in schools, by and large, the teachers and a lot of the kids and people that we met, wonderful characters that we lived close by. At this place we lived in Wasco, after we came onto his land, he then let two or three others come on because he had a big place and he realized, you know, that we were the first, we were going to be all right, and we had 8 kids. So, you know, he wasn't going to be ruined. His property wasn't going to be ruined. So we met a few people there that came on the same way we did, and it was wonderful. I mean, it was just a real good situation, real friendly. everyone was in the same situation. They had that in common. Didn't know where you weren't sure that you were going to eat the next day. You know, you've hoped you could find a job, and that's mainly what we lived on that year was hope.
That's probably not so difficult for a 10-year-old child.
No, it's horrible for mother and dad. I know that.
Mm-hmm.
I saw what a toll it took on them, and I know that that had to be the hardest year of their lives, and the older ones too. You know, that living back and forth with relatives here and in little places, the other places, and that was awfully hard on them.
Yeah, I think that it would be. Being responsible for feeding 8 kids and not
yeah.
knowing where your next meal is coming from is, it's got to be.
Yeah, it's got to be hard on you.
Difficult
right.
Thing. Okay, well, that pretty much covers the questions that I had, unless you have.
I can't think of anything, Judy. I think we've covered it all.
Okay, then we'll shut.